This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. There will be another day of hearings in federal court in Boston about the authority of federal immigration agents. Already, 2 days of hearings have resulted in a promise that federal agents will no longer arrest undocumented immigrants who are visiting government offices trying to gain legal status. Joining us to talk about these hearings is Dina Haynes, professor of law at New England Law in Boston. Dina, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So federal judge Mark Wolf is holding these hearings in federal court. And during them so far, what we've heard is that he's harshly questioned some U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement officials about practices and about specific arrests. How common or uncommon are hearings like this?
The questioning itself is not uncommon. The harshness of the questioning is somewhat uncommon. And the video that he showed in court and asked the officers to watch along with him and respond to is unprecedented.
Well, you know, we actually have a little bit of tape of that. So let's play a little bit of that video. It's about the arrest of Lucimar de Souza, a Brazilian immigrant married to an American. She was separated from her children for 3 months after she was detained at a government office in Boston. And during the hearing, as you said, Judge Wolf played this emotional video of her reuniting with her 10-year-old son, and he played it twice. Let's listen to a little bit.
Vai!
That is Lucimar de Souza reuniting with her 10-year-old son after she was held by immigration officials. So this is what you say is very emotional and unusual for a judge to do, to ask ICE about this, right?
Correct. And it wasn't just any government office. It was another branch of the Department of Homeland Security. So ICE was arresting people at its own affiliate, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Office.
Yeah. What did the judge say to people when he showed this video?
I believe he asked the two officers, or the three officers eventually, to watch along with him. He asked them whether they had children, to which they responded yes. And he asked them to describe how it felt to watch these families be reunited.
Now, Thomas Brophy, the current acting director of Boston's ICE field office, said that ICE has stopped arresting undocumented immigrants who are visiting government offices. And this is really a reversal, this promise. So how significant is that? And do we know, or is it only a guess, whether this hearing actually played any role in that?
Well, Brophy claimed that it played no role, that in fact the policy had been made to discontinue this practice prior to the hearings. There's some evidence that contravenes that to an extent, in that I believe one of the officers reviewed all of the detention policies and discovered that there were 20 people still in detention, but only did so after the first case was heard in court. So I think that it's quite significant in that ICE has been arresting people both at state courts and at other government offices, and that other courts around the country could look at this case as persuasive and decide that ICE doesn't have the authority. There are constitutional questions at stake here as well.
Right. So regardless of what Judge Wolf might rule here, how will that affect other cases around the country? I mean, they obviously could cite it as a precedent, right? I mean,
technically, it has little effect. There's no policy that we're aware of formally that ICE has declared across the country to stop this practice. I think that it will be somewhat persuasive, but all along, one of the problems that immigration practitioners have had is trying to understand how discretion will be carried out in this kind of environment where there are a lot of discrete and policies that no one knows exist.
Right. So in terms of meaning of any ruling, then we don't know.
Well, for these individuals, it's quite significant that they've been released. They have the opportunity to be vindicated. It's not restitution for the 3 months that they spent in detention, because, of course, ICE has discretion to detain people or not detain people. It elected not only to detain these people, but continue to detain them without any opportunity to make a showing that they were neither a danger to the community nor a flight risk, which is typical practice for ICE.
Now, the judge has asked for data regarding exactly how many immigrants have been denied their rights. There's been an admission by ICE that, yes, in fact, in some cases, rights were, in fact, denied here. I mean, Does that spread out the significance of this ruling and the meaning of it for some of those folks?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think that that, when it happens, would be limited to this field office.
So what happens from here?
These individuals come back to court on May 30th. I believe that Judge Wolf ordered them, the government officials, not to speak to each other about the details of these matters, and the ACLU will probably continue to file similar cases around the country on the same issue.
I'm wondering, there may be some folks, particularly when listening to that very emotional video, who might say, is Judge Wolf being an activist judge here? And is this the place for the judiciary?
It's definitely the place for the judiciary. The Constitution, upholding the Constitution, if the courts aren't going to do it, who will?
But taking a harsh line of questioning toward folks.
I think it was warranted. I agree that the video showing was unprecedented, but I don't think it was unwarranted. ICE does have the discretion to detain people. It has elected to detain people who pose no danger to the community at great cost to U.S. taxpayers. It's not without cost to detain people. It's about $175 per day per person. It's a huge violation of an individual's liberty. At no gain.
All right. Dina Haynes, professor of law at New England Law in Boston. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Boston Globe says it's investigating the public allegations of an inappropriate text exchange between a Globe editor and a former online editor at Boston.com. Globe editor Brian McGrory says he does not recall the exact text exchange with former Boston.com editor Hillary Sargent, whom McGrory says he dated many years ago. Joining us to talk about this is WBUR media analyst and Boston University journalism professor John Carroll. John, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Deb.
So let's start with this text in question. A screenshot of this text was tweeted by Hillary Sargent, who's the former Boston.com editor. So what exactly did it say?
Well, it basically was asking advice about writing and talking about the writing process. And then whoever it was she was having this exchange with, and it's not clear from the screenshot, whoever it was said, well, what do you wear when you write? And she texted back, seriously? And the answer was, well, not entirely. That was seen as by her as an extremely inappropriate exchange to have. She identified the other person as Brian McGrory, but she did not specify at what time, at what period the exchange took place. So that's still up in the air.
Right. The Globe says it's looking for more context, right? Because, as you say, it is very vague. We're not sure really who was involved here in this exchange. Brian McGrory released a statement yesterday saying that he and Sargent dated several years ago, and he has asked her specifically for more information about the timing and the context of this text exchange so far. He says Sargent hasn't responded to him. So I wonder, John, like, how does this issue of prior dating affect all of this? Does it make it more gray, if you will?
Well, I think it complicates things. And part of why it complicates it is because Hillary Sargent did not reveal that. Brian McGrory did. And so that would have been something that people could have and would have taken into consideration when looking at this whole situation. The chronology overall is really vague. Hillary Sargent was an intern at the Boston Globe in 1998 and 1999. In 2014, she went to Boston.com, which is a subsidiary of Boston Globe Media Partners.
And we should say she left after 1999 when she was an intern.
And she has implied that there was some incident that occurred then. She came to Boston.com in 2014. It's an independent subsidiary of Boston Globe Media Partners. So Brian McGrory, if he had been editor at the time of this exchange, would not have been her direct boss.
Okay.
But the Globe made a point of that in the article this morning. But it's pretty clear that Boston.com was sort of the Pawtucket Red Sox of the Boston Globe. I mean, there was a lot of aspirational sort of work that was done there in the hopes that they would move up to the Boston Globe. But the truth of the matter is, technically, Brian McGorry was not her superior, if it happened between 2014 and 2016.
Do we know anything else about their professional relationship?
No, Brian says he's always respected her. Hillary Sargent has been a little bit grudging in terms of more details, especially since the Boston Globe has sent her a draft of a lawsuit that apparently they have not filed yet, but that asks her for more information and also asks for unspecified damages. And that seems a little ominous. Right. Hillary Sargent tweeted this morning that for 6 months, she's been offering to talk to the Globe about the environment in the Boston Globe newsroom and that they have declined to talk about it. She says she has not refused to provide more details. So this is a classic he said, she said, in a number of different ways.
So is the Globe playing hardball with this? Because it's my understanding the Globe is sort of saying, well, you know, under the terms of your severance, you agreed to cooperate with any requests by the, well, with reasonable requests, I think the legal language says, reasonable requests by the Globe in connection with any investigation that may have happened while you worked here, right? So is that standard, or are you saying this is like the Globe playing hardball here?
I think they went to lawyers pretty quick. Maybe they had tried and failed to get details, and so they thought this was their only recourse. It could be that Hillary Sargent is right, that she has been willing to cooperate, and the Globe has taken another path. We just don't know. It's one of the many things we don't know here.
Now, you mentioned that she says that she has offered information to the Globe, but she's also been very critical about the Globe's coverage of sexual harassment within its own ranks. So remind us of that a little bit.
Right. So there was this situation that arose back in December where the Boston Globe was reporting on the Me Too movement in terms of media and how media organizations were handling it. And they said, you know, it's been difficult for us, too. We had a situation where we had a reporter who was pressured to leave because he made inappropriate comments and suggestions to a number of women, one within the Globe, a couple on Beacon Hill. But they did not name him. And that became a point of contention because the Globe, as many people pointed out, is pretty quick to name other people as well. So they eventually named him. His name is Jim O'Sullivan. And that put them in a position where they said the confidence in the transparency of the Globe is something that has been damaged to some degree because of that incident. So I think they carry that baggage into this situation. And in some cases, it would cause people not to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Right. And so how would you describe media response so far to this? Because it seems to be a little more muted than some of the other high-profile cases that we've had recently, right?
This has been interesting on a number of levels. For one thing, it really started at two places where the Kevin Cullen rumpus started about a month ago over his coverage of the Marathon bombings. WEEI and this website called Turtle Boy Sports. From there, it went to WGBH's Greater Boston. They did a segment on it Tuesday night. And then Commonwealth Magazine picked it up, and then more mainstream media are picking it up as well at this point. But it's something that has been, people have been pretty much walking on eggshells over this because it's a difficult situation, for one thing. But also, it's a situation with the Boston Globe, and a number of people are reluctant, at least apparently, to get crosswise with the Globe.
But also, it's a different situation because there seems to be quite a bit of gray area, too.
There certainly is. But one of the other media interesting media aspects is the Boston Herald has stayed away from this assiduously. And they posted something on their website today, but there's been nothing in the paper. And that's been true also of the Kevin Cullen situation. And it's uncharacteristic of the Herald, which usually this is mother's milk to them. And they usually glory in this kind of thing. So that's an unusual aspect as well.
All right. John Carroll, WBUR media analyst and journalism professor at Boston University. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the new NFL policy that says teams can be fined if their players kneel in protest during the national anthem at NFL games. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.